Hello, the internet, and welcome to season 192, episode 4 of The Daily Zeitgeist, a production of iHeartRadio. This is a podcast where we take a deep dive into America's shared consciousness. It is Friday, July 9th, 2021. My name is Jack O'Brien, a.k.a. Yeah, Uncle Joe, UFOs, come on, Miles, let's talk. Three-point shooting. Oh, Cuban Ray, sound attack. Don't do nothing about white supremacy. So sit down, not too loud. I might shout because I'm cute and chuggy. That is courtesy of Chrissy Yamaguchi, man. La Boot Scootin' Boogie, a.k.a. that he said it took him a whole week to write, and unfortunately not really in my range, but well done, sir. And I am thrilled to be joined as always by my co-host, Mr. Miles Gray.
Yes, Miles Gray, but I will just say this, no AKA, just all we need is Bukayo Saka. Bukayo Saka. Bukayo Saka. All right. And, you know, I know that there are other players on the England national team that don't play for my beloved Arsenal. But for the ones that do, that's you, Bukayo. And I see you out there, your young man, doing your thing. The three Lions are through to their first final since 1966. Can you feel the energy? I can. So shout out to all the three Lions supporters out there. I know it's very happy times for you all.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, Miles, we are thrilled to be joined in our third seat by an economist and an independent analyst who hosts the Bubble Trouble podcast, which tells you some inconvenient truths about how financial markets really work. Please welcome Richard Kramer and Will Page. What's up,
fellas? Welcome, welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
How are y'all doing? What part of the world are you coming to us from today?
We are coming to you from sunny London.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. And Will, how about you? Where are you coming to us from today?
I'm speaking to you from 1 mile from the Emirates Stadium, where your boy Saka has honed his track.
Oh, my goodness. You love to
hear
it.
We can hear them cheer when they score, and last season we didn't hear much cheering. So.
No, not at all. Not at all. Do you support a club in the Premier League?
Well, my true club is Heart Midlothian back home in Scotland. Okay. We don't have a trophy cabinet because we ain't won nothing. But down here in London, when you live in Kentish Town, you have to support Arsenal. It's a law. It'd be a felony to go with Tottenham Hotspur. So,
oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You and I can tell you're a self-respecting football supporter when you don't tread into those waters over there. It's not worth anything. Richard, what about you?
Well, you know, as a nice Jewish boy, I think I'd be obliged to support Tottenham. But
right, for sure, I get that. Are you? Do you? But you're living in London. Are you? How has the football caught hold of you? Or what's
you know,
your
30 like? Years on living in London, not really. It wasn't the sport I grew up with. So
what was the sport you grew up with? Baseball, basketball,
more hockey.
Oh, wow. Hockey.
So, you know, you've got to, it's similar passions,
yeah,
but less hooligan violence.
Who's your team in the NHL?
Pittsburgh Penguins.
Oh, okay.
Hey.
Sid the Kid and all that.
A lot
that.
Of success.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Mario Lemieux. I remember those two.
Yeah, there
Pavel
you go.
Burre, didn't he play with y'all too?
No.
Who was the other Eastern European guy who played for the Penguins?
Jaromir Jagr.
Jaromir Jagr. That's, yeah, that always messed me up as a kid.
And he had number 68 on his jersey, which was a reference to the Prague Spring. So,
oh wow.
So. Good for Jaromir. I always, as a kid, not being completely ignorant of Eastern European phonetics and spelling, I was like, I think they misspelled his jersey. It's a J-A-G-R.
Yeah.
But I was 10 and didn't know much about anything. So yeah. There you have it.
Yeah. Will is Scottish, so the England football team is a touchy subject for him.
I get
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so the game finished, I think, at 11:15 last night. Mm-hmm. And by 20:20, I had bought my train ticket to Scotland on Sunday evening. So I am out of the country.
Oh,
should
wow.
they actually go ahead and win it? I just, it's too much for the Scots to handle. They're that close.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm all Italian for the next 72 hours.
Yeah. I mean, trust me, I was definitely rooting for the Scottish team because of, you know, Kieran Tierney, again, another great Scottish player, but also a Gunner as well. So, yeah. But shout out to Hearts, you know, like I can't imagine it's easy to support Hearts.
Yeah, we had an American play for us, a guy called Perry Kitchen. I don't know if you remember him, captain of the American team.
Yeah.
He played for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for some reason, he was incapable of passing the ball forward. I don't think anyone saw him make a forward pass. He was like he confused the rules of rugby with soccer.
There's a lot of, I remember a lot of American players end up going to the Scottish Premiership, you know, like like sort of the first place Americans who are too cowardly to go too far afield. They like to dabble in the Scottish Premier League. I noticed that.
Yeah, it'd be a big fish in a small pond.
Right, right, exactly. That's why Landon Donovan never left. Well, that helped our national team.
Well, you may have seen Billy Gilmore play. Billy Gilmore is a Chelsea 17-year-old. He played for Scotland against England.
Yeah.
Best player on the whole championships. And he couldn't play again because he got COVID in right. between the second and third game.
And that's when Mason Mount had to quarantine, right? Yeah. Because he interacted with him. It's amazing how those little things can affect so many players at one tournament.
So we got this joke back home in Scotland, which is Billy Gilmore, the only positive result to happen in Scotland's European championships. Positive result, COVID. Okay, you get it.
I love it.
Well, it's appropriate. I hear maybe one out of every 10 words that everybody's saying because my internet connection is just completely broken. But I would have had nothing to add to that conversation. So that's works out. But congratulations on the success of the three lines. All right, guys, we are going to get to know you a little bit better in a moment. First, we are going to tell our listeners a few of the things that we're talking about. We are going to have a capitalism, an overall capitalism conversation with you guys, just markets, the rising popularity of socialism, the whole Robin Hood conundrum, all of that, plenty more. But first, Richard, Will, we like to ask our guests, what is something from your search history that's revealing about who you are?
I search a lot of disco and funk from the 70s and 80s.
Oh, wow.
Before okay. my time, but it tells you a lot about who I am. Like somebody who's spent past 15 years at the front of music technology, I'm always going back.
Well, you worked at Spotify, correct? You said?
That's right. For the best part of a decade at Spotify.
Right.
And then prior to that, working with songwriters and publishers too. So a balance of the rights holder and the rights user. Yeah.
Got it. And all you can think about is 70s, 80s disco and funk. I like that.
Yeah. As far as music goes forward, I keep on going back. That's always been the story with me.
Are there any bands now that you feel like, what about like Jungle? Are they adjacent enough to get your toe tapping?
It's a great one. Jungle's on my mix. That mix on Mixcloud got 38,000 uniques. It beat Erykah Badu, an LA star, in terms of popularity, which is great. But I'll give you one. This is a big one for your listeners, and I have to spell it out to you because it sounds weird. Salt. Now write this down. S-A-U-L-T. Salt.
Yes.
That is the hottest band coming out of London right now, and it's just nobody knows who they are. Nobody knows what they look like. They don't do any press. They're completely incognito. Yeah, it's just bubbling right now. People
are love
just
that track.
A new record.
Why? That's love that track. We've actually ridden out on a couple Salt tracks because I look Spotify. They know how to serve me the things I'm looking for, and it gave me a heavy dose of sodium, or in this case, salt.
Salt's the one for me. I'll go on record and say it's the most powerful music I've heard since discovering Massive Attack. And discovering Massive Attack is pretty much on par with losing your virginity, and it's that good.
Okay, I like that.
You had a better experience losing your virginity than me, it sounds like. go ahead, Richard.
Well, I will say I'm absolutely right with Will on the 70s and 80s funk. That's something we're completely in sync on. But... Wow. It's a bit of a trick question for me because I don't have any search history because I was one of the early investors in a browser called Brave, which I'd recommend everybody to be using. It is the privacy safe browser, but it basically makes sure that you're not tracked when you're using the web. Okay. And it keeps all your history hidden away. And so given my memories fading constantly, for whatever reason, I can remember what I searched for a few minutes ago, but not after that. And I don't have to worry that search history is sitting there for decades in somebody else's servers.
Sure.
So you're immune from this question.
I guess every once in a while you want to figure out, hey, what was that I found? But you realize it's probably really not that important and just... Think right. of the next thing instead.
How do you stay organized? Because I'm one of these people who has like 9 million browser tabs open because I don't want to forget things. But the way you're talking, you're like, I don't know, maybe I searched it, but it's all good. Do you have like a tome that you write this stuff down?
I also have 9 million browser tabs open at times.
Okay.
But then you just got to go through and cull them. And
right.
the point is when you close them, you want that history to be gone.
Yeah.
What is something you guys think is overrated?
I can give you something that's overrated and something that's underrated in the world of sport.
Okay.
I think men's football is overrated and women's football is underrated. I reckon in 10 years' time, you're going to see a massive equalization, a massive convergence, if you want, of the two games. Trust me, when I saw 73,000 people turn up for England women versus German women at Wembley Stadium, it was a day of reckoning. So, you know, you can look at gender in sport and see an inequality pretty much everywhere you look. And I think the next 10 years, you're going to see a very, very sharp correction there. So overrated, Mehmet Özil for Arsenal getting £350,000 a week, twice what Boris Johnson gets a year. Underrated women's footballers who are still pretty much amateur, semi-professional status. Watch that correct itself.
Yeah, especially the talent in the leagues are phenomenal. I watched like the Champions League final with PSG. Like I really love it, and especially the Arsenal ladies team is stellar. Viviane Miedema is one of my favorite players to watch.
I didn't realize Premier League teams had women's teams as well.
Not all of them do, but many of them do. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Richard, how about you?
Yeah, I would say the one thing I feel strongly is completely overrated is pretty much anything to do with social media, and specifically Twitter, which I consider the id of Western civilization. It's the kind of thing that, you know, if I watch you guys walking down the street together and amiably chatting, I wouldn't take any notice of it. But if I watched you walking down the street screaming at each other, I'd stop and take note. And I think that's the kind of behavior that a lot of social media engenders. And I think it's the kind of thing that everybody feels the need to show how clever they are, put something out there, but it has so little substance and it's such a distraction engine that it's really wildly overrated. I think there's lots of other ways to see distribution of interesting ideas and content and news. And I think the thing that's underrated is sort of the contemplation you get reading a book. Will just published Tarzan Economics, giving him a shameless plug for that. But, you know, reading and engaging with content, I think podcasts are the same thing. When you feel as if there's a conversation that you're part of, I think that's fascinating and way underrated because you feel a connection. And I think this sort of bite-size, constant flow of distraction in social media is really damaging.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can build on that a couple of points. There, just one, I always reminds me when I hear Richard talk about this of what Groucho Marx said, which is, you know, back then he said, television's a fantastic invention because every time I switch it on, it reminds me to read a good book. And I just wonder what he would say about Twitter and Facebook and the like today. And I often look at a lot of that social media as junk food, and keeping with that food theme, a colleague of ours, Noemi Drew, she said to me once, what Twitter is the ability to, you're sitting at a big dining table, lots of guests, and everyone's broken off into private conversations, and Twitter allows you to eavesdrop into all those private conversations. And I thought, if somebody doesn't tweet, it's a nice illustration of what it might actually mean to us. But then you have to step back and say, well, why would you want to eavesdrop into all those private conversations? Why not have a deeper one with something you can reward yourself from as opposed to all these distractions? So yeah, it does come across as junk food to me. So I'll ditto Richard's point there.
But Miles, I'll something that hopefully you're aware of is that about a month ago, the entirety of UK sport, every sport, rugby, cricket, tennis, football, all said complete ban on social media for 4 days over a bank holiday weekend, because the original sin of Twitter is allowing people to be hashtag raving racist or hashtag, you know, I love abuse. And it's just absolutely shocking. And I say this in all seriousness, I think it is the id of Western civilization. All the things that we, you know, in classic psychoanalysis or psychology, you'd never say to people in polite company. All the terrible thoughts you have in your head that you would never voice directly to somebody.
Right.
People say them all the time on Twitter.
Yeah.
And you know, you have someone who's you know, an icon and just deserving of the highest of respect, like Marcus Rashford in the UK with all the stuff he's done with school lunches and so forth. And he just gets the most unbelievable invective of abuse.
Yeah.
And you don't know where it's coming from. And of course, no one is going to walk up to him in the street and say these things.
Right.
And yet the entirety of sport, it wasn't just one sport, it wasn't just a few athletes, It was everybody said, this has got to stop. We got to take a break here because we're not going to contribute to this constant bubbling up of an invitation to take pot shots at us.
Yeah. No, I totally. Yeah. It's there's the amount of, especially the racial abuse hurled at like athletes is gobsmacked is the word I would use when I look at some of the things that I read. And yeah, that even forced one of my sporting idols, Thierry Henry, to like deactivate his accounts. And he's saying, I'm not fucking with this at all. If this is what people come here for and the companies allow this to just run rampant, what is the point? Yeah. And that's why I think a lot of, you know, our guests, even who are comedians, come on to say like, you know, we can't stand social media because there's a certain level where, especially for comedians, like it's a place to get their jokes off. But on the other side of that, it allows for a lot of people to just come at them and say all kinds of ridiculous things that, again, like you're saying, Richard, you would never hear someone say that to your face. And so we've had to like, we've built up these weird calluses emotionally to even engage in social media that, you know, I'm sure resonate in many other ways.
So I had a UK member of parliament say to me, you know, how can it be correct that something that you would be arrested for telling someone in the street to their face, you can say every day on social media? And Will tell you the language that's been hurled at Nicola Sturgeon, the leader of the Scottish National Party. You know, she gets all sorts of rape threats or what have you on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't callous yourself entirely to that stuff. It just no one can.
Right.
But on interpreting it, like when Richard just mentioned it, it was what was inside people's heads all along, but now it's pouring out. That reminds me of like one day. The anomaly of crime stats is a good reminder for how do you interpret all this activity? So it goes like this. If crime stats are up, what do we know that's happened? Either A, crime is on the up, or B, we're getting better at catching criminals, or C, we've changed the definition of crime, or D, a combination of all of the above. But it doesn't necessarily mean crime is on the up. It means now we're seeing what people had inside their heads all along. I think that's an important contextual point about trying to make sense of this madness as well. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, the neutering effect that banning Trump from social media had is something that we talk about a lot on this show. But like, that's truly that was a moment when I really had to like sit back and be like, wow, we haven't figured this out yet, and like that. What he did, the way he used social media, like hopefully, I'm assuming years down the road, like that won't be possible in one way or another, because it was just so damaging.
Now the worry for Scotland is he's kind of done his time in America. Is he going to come back to Scotland and open more golf courses? Because we got rid of him for a few years whilst he was making a mess of your place.
Yeah,
maybe. I mean, it seems like the Scots are definitely more united in giving him a hard time than the people of the U.S. So I don't know. Who knows if there's maybe a little MAGA contingent in Scotland, maybe he'll find it there. But it seems like Florida is the place for him at the moment.
Florida's got better weather than Scotland. Scotland, we have two seasons, winter and June, and that's your lot. So
winter and June. I love it.
That's amazing. All right, guys, let's take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about the news. And we're back. And just kind of up top, you know, we talk a lot on this show about socialism, you know, some of the ways that we feel like capitalism has been damaging to our current version of society. And I guess I just wanted to kind of get you guys, as people who spend a lot of time thinking about markets and capitalism, like what are you guys' thoughts on just the rise of popularity of socialism in the modern world and like how that fits into the evolution of markets and capitalism in the Western world, I guess.
Yeah, if I can take a stab at unpacking this one, I'll draw an example I flag in the first chapter of the book Tarzan Economics, which is when people, you know, sort of frame the debate around capitalism and communism, there's often like an axiom underneath all this, which is that capitalism kind of removes the safety net, and that encourages an entrepreneurial spirit. If you win big. If you lose hard. But there's no complacency. It keeps you on your toes. Whereas socialism, that imposes a safety net. And if there's a safety net, nobody takes any risks. And if nobody takes any risks, nobody wins big and nobody loses. And there's a stereotype there of how economies or societies, perhaps a better word, work under capitalist models and socialist models. And what I draw on in the book Tars and Economics is to look at the entrepreneurial spirit in the free market capitalist country that is the United States of America, and compare that with the entrepreneurial spirit in the very left-leaning socialist economy of Sweden. And I don't see a drought in entrepreneurial activity in Sweden. I see startups galore. iZettle, Spotify, Clara, the list goes on and on. I see a country that's getting rid of cash next year. You know, they're getting switching off the FM radio band next year. One of the earliest adopting countries that you'll ever find. So I'm not sure the stereotypes of what is capitalism and what is socialism work down on the ground. And I just want to toss this back at you guys, which is, yes, I get it. The US model of capitalism encourages risk-taking, encourages reward, incentivizes the entrepreneurial spirit. But maybe, just maybe, the Swedish model, which has this really strong social safety net, you know, which keeps people above the poverty line, provides great maternity and paternity leave, amazing child support, allows you to take 6 months out of work to study, allows you to take 9 months out of work to try a startup even. Maybe this model, because the social safety net is so strong, it encourages even more entrepreneurial activity. So it's just a way of thinking about, is it either or is the line a little bit fuzzy between these two models? I'm fascinated with how Sweden, with all of its safety net, with all of its socialistic beliefs, has produced such a great entrepreneurial success story.
But how am I going to want to get out of bed in the morning if I am not scared that I'm going to starve to death? I don't see it. Or if I'm afraid that I can't give my kids health care, that's the only thing getting me out of bed. No, I think that's exactly
every donkey
right.
needs a carrot, right? Every donkey needs a carrot.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so many things I could pick up on there from what Will said, but I think the way you guys are posing it is a complete false dichotomy. And when I look back at where I grew up in the States, but left a long time ago, more than half my life ago, left there. You know, the U.S. isn't a capitalist economy in any sense. There's enormous social support for large companies. And
right, for the wrong things you're saying. I like that.
I think one of the sad things that's happened in the past 30, 40 years is this notion, and it's been a very deliberate notion, to undermine the idea that there is any value in collective enterprise or the government or what have you. And this back to the Reagan era of, oh, well, you know, the worst words are that I'm here from the government, I'm here to help you. I mean, and Michael Lewis wrote a book on this just recently, you know, which was basically a love letter to the folks who toil away for relatively low salaries working on food safety in the U.S., working for the government. We're glad that we have these people doing this in so many different endeavors. And we've had this idolatry of the individual, which looks down on the collective enterprise. And I think what Will's describing in a society like Sweden or Denmark or other countries which have a higher degree of social cohesion is that everybody's willing to get in it together. And I think one aspect of this that I really take a lesson from is my nephew did a PhD at the University of British Columbia in psychology, and he was studying happiness. And the thing about happiness is once you hit a point where you have pretty much enough of what you want, you get to something called satisficing. And I'm sure Will can go on and on about this. But having more doesn't make you happier. Mm-hmm. Having more stuff, having more money, and it's this, almost a psychosis that has gripped people because they've been marketed this myth of capitalism that we have this complete constant gladiatorial arena that we're fighting in every day, that we don't find ways to have more collective enterprise and appreciate the collective enterprise at the neighborhood level or up to the nation state level.
Yeah, I like to wrap that one up by saying, Some is better than none. We're not advocating communism here. But more is not necessarily better than some. Mm. And that needs to be tattooed on our foreheads when we're studying economics or interpreting economic analysis, which is, it doesn't necessarily mean I need that extra dollar as much as I needed that last dollar. I think that's where it breaks down. If I just quickly come back to Sweden as well, another observation is that when startups scale in Sweden, and forgive me for picking on one of a handful of Scandinavian economies with similar models, but in Sweden, when you see startups scale, they scale fast in their own country. You know, Spotify launched in late 2008. By 2010, a large chunk of the Swedish population was using Spotify, and America had never even heard of streaming. So it scales fast. Now, I just wonder whether you've got a social safety net and a greater deal of equality in your economy. If one person has a good idea, it can spread to all people a lot faster than in a strictly capitalist economy with a bigger gap between rich and poor, where you might have one good idea, but it can't reach to all because a lot of people are priced out of the bargain. So it's worth just, you know, playing this social safety net argument out, not just on the creator side, but also on the consumer side. Mm. All people can win when ideas scale.
Sure. And I'm curious to think, like, just with this, you know, as you're saying, Richard, like, we definitely have social safety nets for these large corporations, and that there's like this, the emphasis is to always, it seems like, if just speaking very narrowly about the United States, that if there is some kind of crisis that an industry is facing, the first thing is to make sure that the business owners themselves are the most sort of protected, while there's really not much consideration that goes down towards the workers who are actually keeping the businesses alive. Mm. Is there any way to, because I think what you're saying, like, you know, there's this idea of more and more and more that it almost seems like unending, that can, you know, people who are dealing with, you know, in big supporters of free market capitalism arrive at a point to say, is there a limit? Because at a certain point, if we're too obsessed with growth and we look at just the huge gap between incomes from the people in the C-suite, middle management down to just, you know, maybe hourly workers for a given company, how that can equalize in some level? Or is that just completely runs afoul of how maybe these business owners think?
Well, and I think you raise a key point, which is how people understand the world. And certainly the level of concentration in the media market in the U.S. is fairly extreme. And while it's fragmented or splintered with the internet in the past few years, it's still largely controlled by a handful of companies who are going to give a very certain message. Now, mm-hmm. I'll take another example of a different country called Japan. In Japan, they realized a long time ago that they have no oil. They have relatively few natural resources. It's an island. And they, I believe, deliberately engineered a zero growth economy with the idea in mind of sustainability. And they deliberately leave something like 70% of the arable land in Japan as forests and leave it fallow. And they have people live in megacities. The Tokyo, Osaka, Nagoya corridor is 60 million plus people. It's half the population of the country. But they realized if they just cut down every tree, they'd end up like Easter Island, which, you know, we know that the people there, we believe that the people there effectively extincted themselves because they overused their natural resources. And there's nothing wrong with accepting no growth if, when you look at all sorts of surveys, generally Japanese people are incredibly happy on a global scale. They don't have the tremendous inequality between the rich and the poor. They've long ago had debates about what the appropriate multiple of the lowest paid worker in a business should be paid versus the boss. Mm-hmm. And they have a very rigid, very collective oriented culture. Now, it's very unique. It's not something you could extrapolate. But the message there for a very long period of time was to preserve resources, not to overconsume. And everybody bought into the program. And it's not some hippy-dippy utopian community. It's a country of 120 million people and one of the top 5 or 10 economies in the world.
I'm half Japanese, and, you know, philosophically, there's very much an idea of if you can do something, do it well and have a business that can do it for as long as possible. That's why Japan has the highest concentrations of businesses that have been around for over 100 years with this sort of same philosophy of we don't need to open multiple franchises or things like that. We do this one thing, we do it well, the business is consistent, and that's what we're interested in, you know, culturally. Mm. But just to kind of come back to the U.S., I'm curious, you know, because now you've been living in the U.K. and things, and I'm sure you have a very broad perspective on everything that's going on. Do you think that that at a certain point, the stakeholders of like the large corporations in the United States could arrive at a realization that eventually says, is this actually sustainable in the long term in terms of like if we keep hollowing out the middle class and end up with a large chunk of people who are completely impoverished and don't have access to things like the most basic things, is it at any level, do you think people in the C-suites there think there's a responsibility, or that's just that's like a fantasy world that doesn't exist?
I would hope that they do, but then it's the seriousness of the commitment. And you see this, every single Fortune 500 company will make the most charming, glowing promises about sustainability, just as last year they made incredibly sincere promises about racial justice. Mm-hmm. But then the proof is in the pudding. And it's always easier to request that somebody else in the organization takes hold of that, or as long as it doesn't eat into my comp package, you know, who suffers for that, or who is relatively disadvantaged for that? I won't say suffering. And look at the debate in the U.S. over the tax structure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think tax deductibility of interest, in one respect, has been a tremendous incentive to people to take risk. But for a lot of other people, it has been an invitation to exercise enormous inequality and irresponsibility. And a college friend of mine, Jesse Eisinger, just published some phenomenal work in ProPublica, which I'd recommend everybody to look at, covering the tax contributions, if you wouldn't want to call them that, the tax income from the 15 wealthiest Americans. Yeah. So now Jesse's point, which I think is very valid, is these people did not do anything illegal.
Right.
We're not saying that they broke the law, but is this the kind of society we want where if you have a lot of money, you have all of these legal means to ensure that you literally never pay tax? And if you don't have a lot of money and you can't hire tax consultants or trust fund trustees and so forth, you're stuck with everyone else, mm-hmm. you know, paying the taxes as you expect. And the question is, what sort of society do we want to have? And then the question following that would be, who gets to decide that? And I think, I'm sure Will has a lot to add on this topic, but we're looking at doing this as a topic for Bubble Trouble, because it raises the question of, are you allowing people to accrue two big pots of wealth relative to everyone else? And therefore you're in a biological sense, you're narrowing the gene pool of what's likely to happen with all that capital sloshing in the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. If I can drop one transatlantic observation, if you want, about this, it rolls up to leadership as well.
Yeah.
There was an election campaign where Mitt Romney ran against Barack Obama, I believe. I can't place a date on it.
2012.
And Mitt Romney said on record, he said, "I paid 12% tax last year and not a penny more," and people cheered. Now, they cheered. If somebody running for prime minister or president in a European economy was to say that, they would be booted off the campaign ticket.
Mm-hmm.
It was fascinating to see how he was celebrating how little tax he had paid.
And sure.
There's a backstory to that, which is on that campaign, he actually wanted to get rid of capital gains tax. And somebody said to him, "Well, what would the poor people say to that?" He said, "Oh, they don't vote anyway." I mean, that's a potential president of the United States talking like that on the record to his proposed electorate. And it's just really interesting to like zone in on that as a simple observation and say, if you said that in Sweden, if you said that here in the UK, you'd be off the campaign, not on the campaign. For Americans, you celebrate it. For us, we criticize it.
Well, yeah, I think that goes hand in hand with, like, you know, leadership and the concentration of people who are able to access things like the media and even have, you know, deploy their lobbyists to make sure their interests are protected legislatively. Hmm. We have a very conflicted system. Plus, I think on top of that, Americans are probably the most propagandized people on the planet when it comes to, like you're saying, every other person would be like, "Get the fuck off the stage with that. We're fucking dying." And people are like, "Yeah, man, don't pay your taxes, because I've created this like weird false class solidarity with billionaires because I'm holding out for this one day chance that I could be a millionaire. And I don't want to spoil that moment if it arrives by, you know, backing progressive tax policies. And so, yeah, like we're in a very unique situation where at every level, you know, as you say, with leadership, there's a revolving door from business to government back to business again. And even my time lobbying, I've seen how all of the moneyed interests work to specifically undercut legislation or keep people out of office, because it's at the end of the day, like we've allowed a lot of people the tools to meddle. And if you have the resources, you can. And that, you know, unfortunately reverberates down the entire, you know, down to the bottom, from the top to the bottom. And yeah, I think that's what puts us in a terribly unique situation.
One thing that brings me out in a rash is general consensus. And I feel we're all in agreement here. So I got to challenge the groupthink and just throw an observation about America to show where you might see collectivism. And collectivism is about where do you draw the boundaries? You know, we all have our little niches, our little echo chambers. Maybe we find collectivism there. So let me pivot from American football to the American fiscal transfer system. Hold this in your head for a minute. So in American football, you've got the college draft, which essentially says the worst team in one season, period one, gets the best draft picks to hopefully improve their performance in the next season, period two. What a great model of socialism that you have in sport, right? And I remember sitting with the Freakonomics, Steve Levitt from Freakonomics, saying, we need to build this for the teacher system. So the best graduates from teacher training colleges are sent to the worst schools. So you have this self-correcting model. You could learn a lot from American football, not European football, American football. Mm-hmm. But then you look at the fiscal transfer system in America, which essentially says in the 80s, if New York is booming and California is bankrupt, I'm going to transfer a fiscal surplus from New York to accommodate the fiscal deficit in California. That's an interesting model of collectivism, which holds the United States of America united. It holds it together. My point being, we have the European currency here, but you don't have fiscal transfers. You wouldn't have Germany transferring its wealth to the Spanish economy.
Oh, you absolutely. But you absolutely do, Will. You absolutely do.
You do not. I mean, no, you don't. You have Germany buying bonds and basically owning half of Europe, but you don't have transfers of wealth. There's a difference.
Yeah.
I can save your ass or I can buy your ass. Which one do you want to pick?
The funding of the EU budget for poorer countries comes from the wealthier countries.
Right. And just in the same way, you have states here that are helping, you know, fill these sort of gaps in states that aren't able to sustain their own, you know, programs within the state, like Kentucky, for example. They rely on federal subsidies that states like where I'm from, California, pay into.
Yeah.
But I think where the disconnect happens is despite all of that money moving around, the actual end result for the constituents, for the people who are just living, those are not really felt. Like there's a certain point where it fails to, you know, famously trickle down to those people and they can get caught up. And again, I think this is why we have a lot of failures of leadership from the state level to the municipal and a lot of rigid thinking on how people should be supported and things like that. So I think
if you go back to a very simple phrase that comes from Thomas Jefferson, which is representative democracy. Mm-hmm. I think it's a travesty in the UK, the first past the post system, because it ensures that one group that has 35% can constantly be in power over two other groups that are split between 32% each. And in the US, you have every single senator being a millionaire.
Yeah.
And how is that somehow representative of democracy? And if you would figure some algorithmic model for sampling on a representative basis, 100 plus 435 people that would represent the totality of America, you certainly wouldn't come up with a group that looks like
the Senate.
The Senate or the House
half
of Parliament.
Of Congress, yeah.
Or the House of Parliament. And, you know, the Jeffersonian ideal was that every citizen would, and of course at that time he was excluding a lot of people that we would, you know, don't include women or blacks or what have you, but, you know, every person that he saw as a citizen would at least have the capacity, the propensity to serve. And it was all our duty to serve. And now we have representative democracy that represents really quite ideally the people who they are.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really represent the wider populace, or and equally, it doesn't represent, because it's all on such a very short cycle of thought, it doesn't encourage countries to have, and this is what they do have in Japan and they don't really seem to have in America, a 30 to 50 year plan. Where do you want the society to be in 2050? Right. It's 30 years away.
I think right now the thinking is, where do we want people, America, to be in 10 years? Not talking about slavery or critical race theory. That seems to be a lot of like sort of political capital being spent on really not talking about history and things like that, rather than, do we want to actually help create some form of upward mobility for many people?
Yeah. Things like infrastructure take decades to build. And you need a 30-year plan to say, what are things going to look like in 2050, and how do we work backwards instead of fighting over what's going to happen next week or next month or tomorrow on social media?
Going back to something you said, Richard, the idolatry of the individual. So that's why I bring up the increasing popularity of socialism in America, because it's down to like our obsession with individualism and this idea that you make it on your own without any help or social safety nets. Like the thing that is causing those people to cheer for Mitt Romney, it's so thoroughly written into the DNA, like down to a cellular level of like the individuals in America, that I'm very encouraged that there's a generational change happening, where it seems like for the first time in a long time, that is kind of being unwritten, like decoded out of our like kind of societal DNA. Like that we're growing more and more open to it. But it seems like the Mitt Romney generation, the baby boomers and stuff, are just so thoroughly bought into that idea of bootstrapping, like to the point that when a billionaire releases their book, they rewrite their story so that they never got any help from anyone. And it's a lie that has been like part of America's DNA for so long that I think we're going to need to overcome to fix really any of the things that we're talking about.
Because I think a lot of the younger people are seeing, you know, that we're dealing with the effects of, you know, this kind of reckless way that corporations operate in the United States, of just hoarding a lot of wealth, not considering what happens to the entirety of the nation. And so you have a lot of people growing up looking at their situation, and it's completely different than their parents. Like in the 80s, like people just could be like, yeah, man, you can get a house and for nothing, and just do what you got to do, start families. It's all there right there for you, or for most people. And a lot of people like myself graduating college in 2007 and looking at the recession and everything that's going on, I'm like, oh, this is a completely different game. I don't have the same access to the kinds of employment that would immediately put me in the middle class, immediately put me in a place to be able to obtain real estate, or, you know, that's a traditional form of wealth accumulation for people in the United States. That game is like, oh, I feel like I pulled up to a different party and it's still over. And I think a lot of people, especially millennials, have found themselves thinking like, well, now we got to ask ourselves, how do we get here, and how do we end up in a place where we're not worried about the most minute things that we didn't think we had to worry about as kids, which is like, am I covered medically? Or do I know that if there is a pandemic happening, that I won't be evicted from my home because everything was shut down and I have no means of actually generating any income?
Yeah. All right, let's take a quick break and we'll come back and continue this conversation. And we're back. And during the break, I mean, this is going to be sort of an abnormal episode of TDZ, where we don't really get into the stories, but this conversation is just super interesting and we want to continue to have it because it is a theme and sort of the subject that is written through basically every story that we cover on the Daily Zeitgeist. But during the break, you guys were talking about Thomas Piketty as somebody who has sort of some interesting ideas. He wrote Capital in the 21st Century, which was kind of a massive, successful book that I think came out of nowhere. A lot of people were surprised by how successful it was. And I don't know, it was a critique of a lot of the things that we've been talking about as kind of poisoning our various societies.
I'll mention one thing that I really took from Piketty, and then I'll turn it over to Will to talk about quantitative easing, which is, you know, just such a sexy topic. You can't stay away from it. I mean, to me, the point of Thomas Piketty was really the way in which if you start with some money, it's easier to have much more money. And that money has been accumulating in the form of bank accounts or sitting in cash, which doesn't circulate in the economy. When money sits in the bank, it's not doing anything. And I think one of Piketty's key points was there have to be greater incentives to circulate that money in the economy. And look, one of the things that really breaks my heart in London that I hate to see is in the past 20 years, certainly under Boris Johnson as mayor, you've allowed all these developers to build these super luxury flats. And they're all bought by offshore buyers, whether right. It's from Asia or from the Middle East or Russia or whatever. It's a subtle form of money laundering. We can discuss the debate that. But the problem I have with those flats is they're all empty.
Right.
So you go by one of these luxury developments that's in the middle of London in my neighborhood, a beautiful spot, and you can see up 10 stories and there's no lights on. And that money is not circulating. That resource is not circulating in the economy. That would be a wonderful place to have nurses live or teachers live. One of these developments is right across from a primary school that my daughter attended, you know, but the teachers could never afford to live in these luxury flats. And my idea for that would be you should whack a great big occupancy tax on empty flats. And they shouldn't just be accumulated as an asset for offshore buyers that doesn't contribute to the local economy. Because when no one's living there, they're not going to the off license. They're not going to the local restaurant. They're not sending their kids to the primary school. They're just leaving the flats empty because they think they're going to be worth more in 5 years. And you need something that gets those flats circulating in the economy that makes it so painful to sit on that asset that it's worth letting it out to somebody and actually having someone that lives there as a benefit to society instead of as a fallow asset sitting in the middle of town. Mm-hmm. Will?
So, I mean, I like how Rich is using that word circulating. Where does all this money sit? You know, who's it percolating through towards? Who feels the impact of that cash? Is it the few or the many? And there's a way that you can go from Piketty to a real life example, which is if you look at the response to the financial crisis 2008 onwards, and you're still seeing this today, you're still seeing central banks around the world, especially in the Western world, deploy quantitative easing as a way of holding up the financial sector's balance sheet. Now, there's 2 points I want to make here. I want to dive into the technical details of quantitative easing, but I want to make a macro point about where is it and a micro point about what impact is it having. So at the higher level, if you think about where is it, if you look at the UK economy, and I'm pretty sure the same numbers check out for the US, around about a third of the stock of debt this country has, we owe to ourselves through quantitative easing. It's essentially an IOU between the central bank and the treasury function. Last time I checked, a broadly similar figure applied to the United States. So if you think about how countries set policies, if they have a towering stock of debt, they might opt for austerity to reduce the stock of that debt. Well, is there not a case for a debt jubilee when you owe a third of that debt to yourselves? This is not pure modern monetary theory here. It's just a different way of thinking about what is money? If that huge towering stock of debt that's clouding over my fiscal policies is making me more risk averse about, you know, building a social safety net, if a third of that debt I owe to myself, well, why not just wipe it off and allow more fiscal stimulus into the economy, allow more spending? Not such a radical proposal. Moving perhaps a bit more of a radical proposal, one that I've always argued ever since I got my head around quantitative easing, is if you're going to have quantitative easing increase in the economy by X percent, then how about this? You increase the minimum wage by Y percent to pool the money through. Let's go back to what Richard Kramer was saying about circulating, just money washing around and nobody's feeling the benefit. Not a bad example is quantitative easing. I'm going to increase quantitative easing because the banks are under stress. Great. So let's balance up their, you know, back up their balance sheets. All that's happening is you're getting asset price bubbles.
Right.
If you increase the minimum wage by a similar degree, it would help pull money through from Wall Street to Main Street, as you Americans like to say. Again, right. Not that radical a proposal, given the alternative to what's happened. A,
right.
We have huge towering stocks of debt, which B, we owe much to ourselves, and C, all I've done through policy is create asset price bubbles, which benefit the very few as opposed to having any impact whatsoever on the many. And that's, I don't want to sound like a radical here. That's the facts.
Right. And I mean, I think that's what a lot of people think, is that it's just inflating asset prices that just benefit, just enriching the wealthier. I think, but for people who want to look at that with rose-tinted glasses, they'll say, well, then maybe it'll trickle down to everyone else because of that. And I think, yeah, it's true. This is where it becomes interesting, because again, raising the minimum wage, right, is something that's massively popular with people in the United States. But then you have bodies like the Chamber of Commerce that are lobbying actively senators that they're calling out and giving bipartisanship awards for their part in being a no vote in increasing like minimum wage and things like that.
Geez.
And it becomes very cynical, because you're at the end of the day, we're thinking, what? We already look at what it costs to live in a given city, and most places are unaffordable with one job or the subsistence wages a lot of people are paid. So, at what point, this is why we find ourselves in this terrible, terrible place where I think it's whether it's, you know, radical collective action, which I think is what it's going to take for people to see what the potential is for, you know, some kind of more equitable share in this country. But on the other side of it, yeah, a lot of people who are just so exhausted by merely going through the grind of surviving in America, not really ever able to take a moment because everyone has to work. And because of the one moment we had in the pandemic where things stopped for a second, it really did give people, you know, the opportunity to take a breath and look at where their energy is going, what they're receiving in turn for their labor, and how that squares with what the realities are of their given city. Yeah. And again, I know you're saying it seems radical to do this, but I think it's because we have there's these patterns or momentum that we have with certain monetary policies that suddenly any tweak to that is considered just like, oh, my goodness, like that's I can't fathom what that would mean, and what that would mean to, you know, what I'm going to say on an earnings call if I had to start paying hourly people more. And then analysts might be asking interesting questions about what that means for our business.
But there is an open question about why companies need to have a certain level of profitability. Mm-hmm. So once they have, I mean, if you think of a traditional, and this is where the current markets are really unmoored from history and from the traditional way of thinking about investment. And I was explaining this to Will on a run we were taking. I've been training Will how to run for the last year.
Slowly, slowly.
Slow. Yeah, he goes very slowly. My training is going very slowly for him. He goes much more slowly than I do. But, you know, the original idea of getting together as a stock company was that the company itself would be able to have some sort of collective action that would produce profits and pay back each of those stockholders a dividend, a portion of the profits over time. And now you have to ask the question, since many companies don't pay dividends or don't plan to, but they seek to generate huge profits, but they sit on them. And again, back to Thomas Piketty, how can it be a good thing when you have some of the largest companies in the U.S. sitting on cash piles of $50 or $100 billion? That money is simply not circulating in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't, you know, these huge accumulations of wealth, while they're certainly justified by the law, you have to ask the fundamental questions, like my friend Jesse Eisinger is asking about the tax policy, is this the best outcome? Is this what suits the long-term interests of society best, to allow these huge accumulations of wealth in these pockets where they aren't being used to help others?
Right. And I imagine the two of you are in orbit of people that have the ability to, you know, who are in a C-suite, who run companies, who are the people that would make those decisions. Do you think those kinds of proposals for people of that wealth class, of just that astronomical bracket, could they come around to that idea to say, yeah, you know what? I do have entirely too much. Because it seems right now there's a very, it seems like a minority of the hyper wealthy are willing to sort of outwardly say, like, there's more that we can be giving back. We do have more than we'll need. But it also seems like on some level, you do need the buy-in of these billionaires on some level for this to happen. Because on the other side of it, it'll be like how ExxonMobil has a playbook to say, like, oh, yeah, we're all for a carbon tax, while aggressively like lobbying as much as they can to take stuff out of infrastructure bills, but outwardly have this persona of like, oh, we're absolutely all about this. It seems like there's, again, from your firsthand experience, do you think that is a sellable proposition to someone who is at the helm of, you know, a multi-billion dollar company?
If I can kick it in with just an outsider looking in, a non-American looking at America, and somebody who's absolutely fascinated with America, an American political junkie. But one thing that fascinates me with the American approach is the belief in the philanthropy model. Mm-hmm. So if you've made a ton of money, it's your duty to give some of it away. That would be seen as generous. But there's a real issue I have with that, and I think a lot of people in Britain have with the way that philanthropy works in America, which is you may think that you want a beautiful modern art gallery in your hometown, but the government might think I'd rather pay the teachers a livable wage. And who should have the choice? And that goes right to the heart of what we're discussing here, which is, hey, I made that business grow, I made that buck, and I'll decide what I'm going to spend on it. I want a butterfly farm, the biggest butterfly farm on planet Earth, right here. Fine. But had you paid your taxes, that money could have been allocated differently. Maybe back to Rich's point about having money washed up in one cul-de-sac, how'd you get that out to filter down different streets and different lanes?
But I'm saying about that idea, right? Let's say you go up to Bezos or anyone who is
Warren Buffett is a great example of someone who doesn't pay taxes so that he can give all his money away, supposedly.
Right. But how would a conversation go? Let's say they're all getting together. Because based on how the lobbyists for their respective companies move, there's no interest for them to pay those taxes. So there's like this active fight where everyone has the same refrain of like, well, I'm not breaking any laws. And I'll acknowledge maybe very narrowly that there's this level of inequality because of the tax code here. But also, like, I'm not really interested in paying that. Like, let's be real. I don't know, like, if that is going to be accepted, because you see the resistance that comes out as it plays out through lobbying, because that's how, you know, that's how these corporate interests are able to maneuver and sort of have these like double speak moments out loud.
So I'll give you my perspective on this, which is, you know, the language of business, which is probably not talked very much on your podcast, but I live day in and day out, is, you know, are companies, if you're assessing companies, you're looking at them and saying, are they good capital allocators? If they have a pool of capital that's handed to them, let's say they raise a bunch of money in an IPO, are they good at allocating that capital such that they'll generate a return? You know, you'd think fair enough. If you gave your buddy $100 to start a lemonade stand, you'd like to think he didn't go down to the pub and drink away 80 of it and then forget to buy lemons. And you know, he's claiming that he's only got $20 left and he doesn't have enough to buy cups, ice, and lemons to start his lemonade stand. So you want to know that people are individually in companies good capital allocators. The problem is that individual companies themselves aren't going to allocate capital to do things like build schools, roads, bridges, all of the public goods that Will can go on for hours about that we need in society. And one of the things that gets skirted over by those who say, yeah, I'm going to make a lot of money, not pay tax, and then choose to give it away is, well, who built the roads that drive to your mansion? Who maintains the environment? Who, you know, there are all these externalities that are looked after, and you choose to opt out from supporting them. And that's, in my view, it's somewhat irresponsible. It's, you know, if everybody's acting in their own individual self-interest, there will be no society. There will be no collective self-interest. We won't have infrastructure or healthcare. And I can tell you, I've been delighted to live in the UK. And, you know, I've had my children born in the National Health Service, and I pay a higher rate of tax than I would in the States. But we have all of our healthcare provided by a fantastic National Health Service that, you know, which unfortunately doesn't pay its employees nearly as much as they really deserve to be paid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe wrap that one up by saying, look at the state of San Francisco and then look at the state of San Francisco airport. It's a good example of the gap that exists between the public service and the private sector.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I guess from your perspective, like, how could you, like, because you're all very well aware of the inequality and able to, like, articulate what the sort of dysfunction is and the pathology of certain parties involved. How would you, you know, knowing the language of people who are maybe focused more on, like, the business of side of everything, what is the conversation that can be had? Because I think on one level, people are like, well, radically X, Y, and Z needs to happen yesterday. Whenever those sort of legislative policies are introduced, it fizzles out immediately. Is there any way that those people could actually find, or how could you solve? Like, are you saying that you're advocating for the government to figure out to say, like, no, this is not how we're doing it. This is all how it has to be. Or do you think that people deserve the agency to be empathetic? Because it seems like when you give people the agency to do that, they're absolutely not interested in helping anyone except for themselves. So what is how do you solve that? And I think there are many different ideologies around how to solve that. But because you are seeing the dysfunction, how would you propose that works in a way that is equitable, most importantly for those who are missing out on, you know, all of the wealth that's being siphoned out?
So maybe drawing on a very brief period of my career as a government economist, working for Gordon Brown, our Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time. But in economics, you always have a cost-benefit analysis. In layman's speak, it's just a debate. I believe I'm right and you're wrong. You believe you're right and I'm wrong. We're perhaps disagreeing about the balance of the costs and the benefits. So if I go back to that Swedish example, social safety nets have costs. Yeah, it's understandable. If you look at where America is today and you were to move to that model, that brings with it costs. You know, if you want to get somewhere, you wouldn't start from here. But it also brings benefits. And I alluded to some of those. The entrepreneurial spirit in Scandinavian economies is as high as anywhere else in the world. The number of startups coming out is sky high as well. There's a lot of risk-taking happening thanks to that social safety net. And if you go back to your point about the minimum wage, it's interesting to think about the cost of the minimum wage. That's bad for profit margins, could create unemployment, et cetera, et cetera. But there's benefits too. Alan Kruger, a dear friend who tragically, you know, is no longer with us, but he famously wrote a paper of Card and Kruger looking at the minimum wage and how it can boost productivity, boost labor market participation. There's other benefits to consider. And I, again, as the non-American on the call, I would just like to see America have a bit more balance when it weighs up the costs and benefits of either option. And I think that could be like just a small step forward in the right direction. It's just to get that balancing point right. It's not just a one-way street. You've got to consider the benefits of these models as well as the costs. And tying that up on minimum wage, I hope, Mike, you can dismiss this as fake news, but when minimum wage was being debated in the American economy, there's a Republican senator who said on record that when I waited tables as a student, I was earning $6 an hour and I was just fine. I got along just fine back in the 70s. And that Republican senator had failed to factor in something called inflation into his analysis. But yeah, if that is the standard of debate your leaders are having, A, that's woeful, but B, let's get balanced. Let's go back to that Card-Kruger paper and think about the benefits of these safety nets as well as the costs. And yeah, sow a seed and maybe it can take root.
One of the things, Miles, that you're kind of alluding to and is one of, I have to throw it in because it's literally my favorite quote, and Will has heard me say this dozens of times, but it's wrongfully attributed to Mark Twain, but really from Upton Sinclair. And it's, never expect a man to understand something when his job depends on not understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that goes a long way to explaining the willful blindness is another. There's a brilliant book written about this, about people's willingness to suspend disbelief. And I just want to raise one quick point about the great, interesting test case we're going to deal with here, which is climate.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I'm sorry, I don't care how many billions you have. you are not going to be able to
escape
completely insulate yourself from a heat dome over a thousands of miles radius area of the country that raises temperatures beyond the point at which human habitation is possible. And you are not going to be able to shield yourself from the externalities of climate. And if one does not contribute to some form of solution, if we all do not amend our behaviors in some way, we know how this is going to end. And especially the people who are presumably best educated because they have the money to educate themselves and their children, there's no amount of money that is going to save Miami real estate on a 50-year view. And we certainly are not planning on a 30-year view as one would need to build the infrastructure that would potentially save the value of that real estate. And yet, you know, if people want to take an ostrich-like approach to it, I guess you can't prevent them from doing so. But that's going to be a super interesting test case to see how all these people who have billions are contributing or not to solve what is clearly a very intractable problem right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting test case. It'll be hopefully
the final test case.
Yeah. Well, you tell me what land you're going to buy where it's not going to be affected by climate change.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Well, that's why we're looking at space, folks.
Yeah. Well, guys, it's been such a pleasure having you and such an interesting, fun conversation. Where can people find you and follow you and hear you?
Well, we have a podcast, Bubble Trouble, produced by Magnificent Noise. And that's wherever you find your podcast, Spotify, Apple, across the board. That's up and running. And Richard represents Arete Research, and you'll see him getting quoted in the media. A fantastic video of him on YouTube with him and Scott Galloway. I definitely recommend people go and check that one out. Really entertaining. And myself, I got the book out. It came out on the 18th of May in the US, and that's Tarzan Economics. And the book and everything you need to find about that book, about the 8 principles and pivoting through disruption, that's up on tarzaneconomics.com.
Nice. We normally ask our guests what's a tweet or some of the work of social media you've been enjoying, but I'm guessing that's not something that you guys have.
Listen to Salt.
Yeah, listen to Salt. There you go.
There was one on LinkedIn which I really liked, which was, just how shit are all these polls that are springing up on LinkedIn, in your opinion? Is it A, really shit, or B, even bigger shit? And even bigger shit is currently 75%, and really shit is 25%. So those polls are really shit. So any poll about which tweet you found interesting is really shit.
And I would definitely say, for anyone that spends a lot of time on social media, there's a fascinating article in The Atlantic by a woman journalist who got her tech-savvy son to make her take a 28-day hiatus from it. And under no circumstance, it was a great quote in there saying, you know, giving it up 98% is hard because you always think you can go back. Giving up 100% is easy. So for all the people that obsessively check the Twitter before they go to bed or can't wait to see how many likes they have on Instagram, go cold turkey for a solid week or two, and you'll probably find yourself a saner, happier, more balanced individual.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll take like a couple days here and there, and then I'll be like, I gotta
really
see what's going on.
A couple days really, or a couple days kind of like,
I didn't do it that much today. I mean, this is I'm in therapy, and I'm like, there's like, you know, have you thought about not using that? Because it sounds like a source of anxiety for you. I'm like, yeah, you're right. So get off of social media as a form of self-care, y'all.
Yeah.
Miles, where can people find you? What's a tweet you've been enjoying?
Find me on Twitter and Instagram, at Miles of Gray. Also the other podcast, 420 Day Fiance. Check that out at twitch.tv/420dayfiance. A tweet that I like, first one, is from Mike Ginn at Shut Up Mike Ginn, tweeting, 39-year-old producer who has Tinder age range set from 21 to 24 years old. Ugh. Dating in LA is so weird.
Just how all these people talk. Wild.
Another one is from Sarah Lazarus at Sarah C. Lazarus. I really love this one. She tweeted, There should be a post-pandemic full-service doctor where you just lie down for a three-hour appointment and five people swarm around you and fix you like a race car. yeah, I would. That would be good. Just a quick health pit stop real quick.
Yeah, complete with the the sound
effects. Yeah,
of
yeah.
The, yeah, high power screws.
Wearing Red Bull racing outfits.
tweet I've been enjoying, at L was a mistake tweeted, gotta respect the longevity of Microsoft Word. Nothing about it works, and it's still the standard. Want to move an image? Go to hell. Edit a PDF? Edit your expectations. Ignore a spelling mistake? How about suck my dick? That'll be $150. you can find us on Twitter at Daily Zeitgeist. We're at The Daily Zeitgeist on Instagram. We have a Facebook fan page and a website, dailyzeitgeist.com, where we post our episodes and our footnotes, where we link off the information that we talked about in today's episode, as well as a song that we think you guys should go check out. Miles, what song are you recommending people go check out today?
Okay, actually, this is a bit of a parody, and it's a 22-minute YouTube clip. If you remember Lo-Fi Beats to Study To, that was like this channel on YouTube that would just have this like running animation and like lo-fi hip-hop beats.
Secret K.
Yeah, where a friend of mine, a fantastic writer, comedian, just overall creative person, Alex Sargent, he over on his YouTube page, The Layman, he's created Low-Key's low-key, lo-fi, relaxing beats to study time crimes too. Because of the popularity of the show Loki. So it's the not only the God of Mischief, but it's low-key lo-fi. And his cousin did some of the beats on there, and they're really good. So if you're a bit of a Marvel fan and you like some lo-fi hip-hop, this YouTube clip is for you, and it's fantastic. It's some great stuff to get your head nod to.
All right. Well, The Daily Zeitgeist is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. That's going to do it for us this morning. We're back this afternoon to tell you what's trending, and we will talk to y'all then. Bye.
Bye.